We are at the height of summer right now, and it's time for transitioning for many birds. We'll talk about that and a whole lot more with our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. My guest, Bill Volkert, back with us, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He worked at Horican Marsh for 27 years, and he's been watching birds for well over 40 years, and he's going to update us on bird populations, feeding in summer, and talk about a few birds that are starting to migrate. And as always, we take your questions and comments as well. Maybe you've seen an unusual bird recently. Maybe you have some questions about birds. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Bill Volkert with us by phone. Bill, hi. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Always great to be with you, Larry. Thanks for asking.
You know, last time you were on, I think it was April, and it was really unseasonable snow and cold. Any lasting effects to bird populations because of that?
Well, the biggest impact was for the early migrants, and particularly here I mean the songbirds. So Canada geese and ducks always migrate early, but they didn't have any problem. There was access to food. But birds such as our bluebirds, one of the flycatchers that migrates early, eastern phoebe, these were birds that really didn't find food. Robins also seemed to be impacted pretty seriously, just because it was not only the cold weather and the stress on the birds, the need for more energy, but the snow cover basically sealed in the food supply, and quite a few of these birds starved out because of that. Fortunately, these are birds that are relatively widespread and abundant, and with a decent summer, they're repopulating, so the survivors are building those numbers back again. And this is something that we'll see, are these ups and downs of bird populations. The bigger concern is when we have a threatened or endangered population where we already have very few individuals, and then the losses just add up to a much higher percentage of the population. So we were lucky that a lot of our songbirds were still further south and hadn't arrived yet.
This is a transition time for many birds, is it not? What's going on?
Yeah, this is really the height of summer for us in a lot of ways, and certainly for our bird life. When I think of the seasons, I look at April and May as the real migration. You know, certainly we do have some birds like Canada geese and red-winged blackbirds and cranes that are moving, sometimes arriving in Wisconsin in late February or early March as the snow melts. But we get these large waves of birds that really start coming in that latter half of April and throughout most of May. So those are migration months. June is the big nesting season. The birds have all arrived, they've established territories, find mates, and now they're busy starting to raise their families. As we get into July, a lot of these birds are now fledging. So the young are leaving the nest, the adults are caring for them, and some of the birds will try a second family, but quite a few of them only raise one single brood for the summer. And we also have been learning more that among some of our songbirds, particularly the warblers, a lot of them aren't even successful breeders until their second year. So this is an additional concern for conservation because these are tropical migrants. They've got to essentially, at the end of summer, fly all the way down into Central or South America, survive there, come back. Some of them may actually breed the first year. A lot of them are just unsuccessful, that what we call floaters. They're moving around looking for a chance, but oftentimes don't find a mate, then have to go south again, survive another journey and another overwinter down south, and then hopefully find a mate and raise a family. And even there, we'll find that birds, there are nest losses. Predators get into the nest. The young fledglings, as they're first getting out, are more vulnerable. And then to make those journeys, there are more and more hazards for these birds. So it's getting a difficult opportunity for some of these long-distance migrants to maintain their populations, and this has been a real concern that some of these have been declining just because of not a single cause, but just it's a more dangerous world for them, and it's always been a little perilous for these birds just to raise enough young in a summer to be able to replace the population. But this has really been at height. The young are out. A lot of them will finish up with one family. Some will find there's enough time. We'll raise a second family, and for a few that have failed the first time around, they may try again yet to raise a family before the summer's up. And as we get into August, this will be the time for the young to strengthen up, fatten up, and the flocks slowly to start to form. And we'll start to see movements in that latter half of August throughout September, October. Different species are moving at different times throughout that period. So this is that real peak now as we're getting toward the height of that nesting season and preparation eventually for fall migration.
Bill in Neenah has a question for you. Let's go there. Bill, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My wife, Mary, and I like to look for sandhill cranes. And we've been very fortunate to see a couple of dozen north of Lake Poygan and some over around Two Rivers. But we've only seen one chick. We saw that chick at the north end of Horicon Marsh. This has all been in the past month. And I was wondering, what's the story on where they're nesting and when the chicks were, you know, more popular?
Yeah.
Question. Well, sandhill cranes are early arrivals in spring for migration and start nesting rather early. So we'll start seeing the young already in middle of May in southern Wisconsin, and throughout that middle latter part of May, the young are coming out throughout the state. So, of course, northern Wisconsin will nest a little later. But like all birds, even a big crane, they're very secretive. And what you may notice is when the cranes first arrive, they're amazingly vocal. They're so easy to find. The adults are setting up territory. They're calling, and I've got a pair right near our house. If another crane flies by, they start sounding off right away to let any bird flying over know that this is occupied territory. So there's a lot of noise, but once they start incubating, they settle down. They get really quiet. And as they raise those young, even for a big, tall bird like that, they like to hide out in the marsh grasses and in the dense cover. And the young, they're oftentimes quite hard to see. I actually was fortunate enough. I was driving around. It was in Horicon Marsh and saw two young that were just out. Oh, they're probably not even a week old. This was in middle of May. And so these birds were, you know, out on the edge where I could actually observe them. The other thing I should mention is that sandhill cranes don't nest until they're about 4 to 5 years old. So you also have a portion of the population as non-breeders, and these are the birds that are a little bit more visible, a little more vocal. They're coming back with the adults, will form their own flocks, what we call bachelor flocks, and those are birds that we may see staging at some of the large marshes and essentially just hanging out. They're feeding, they'll be a little more visible. But the adults, they're not only caring for the young, but they're also being quite secretive.
Bill, thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Janine in Green Bay next. Hi, Janine.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
I was watching a cardinal last night, went to a feeder that was empty, and it took off, left, but did not go to a different feeder that had food. Are they particular about food? Maybe they like it better? Certain foods are better for them? Do they know that?
Well, for our summer feeding, there are some birds that have somewhat predictable food habits. So the cardinals, the rose-breasted grosbeaks will certainly come for the sunflower seed, the Niger seed. We'll see the goldfinches coming for that. And we put out the sugar water for hummingbirds and for the orioles, or even some people will have luck with oranges, or even with grape jelly. I've heard some people can hardly keep up with grape jelly with the orioles, and others will say that their orioles don't even look at it. I've never had orioles here at my house with a great appetite for the grape jelly. And then you get some odd things, such as for myself, I've got a downy woodpecker that comes to my sugar water feeder, to the hummingbird feeder. I still have indigo buntings coming to a seed feeder. And so there are also individual tastes among some birds. So some, yeah, they're pretty predictable and pretty typical, and then you get the odd one in there. And so I say always that the way to get a variety of birds is offer a variety of food and see what comes. But then, of course, important as well is your landscaping. Make sure you have some native plants, some shrubs, and some cover or shelter for the birds so they feel safe as they come and go.
Thank you, Janine. Appreciate your call. Peggy in Plymouth, your turn. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I have a bird at my bird feeder that I cannot identify. he eats sunflower seeds. But the thing about him is he has a red, brilliant ruby red ring around his neck. The rest of him is black and white. He has white stripes on his wings, down his back. Those feathers are all black. And I cannot find him in my bird book.
Oh, what do you think, Bill?
Well, I'm rolling that around in my head, and it does not match up with anything I can think of off the top of my head here as a native bird that would be common to Wisconsin. Obviously, a photo post would really help. I mean, that's worth 1,000 words right there. But something I would oftentimes suggest here is, you know, there are occasionally escaped cage birds.
Yeah.
We have that, especially in the summertime, where there's a good time for them to survive. And I have actually seen these at a few feeders. We had a Brazilian red-crested cardinal at a feeder years ago down by Hartford. And there have been some odd things out there that do get out of the house. So there may also be exotic birds that you will not find in your North American bird book. But what you're describing with the red ring around the neck, that is not a field mark for a typical North American bird. So it makes me wonder if we haven't got something exotic out there.
I would think that might be the case. You might want to look at, other than the birds of North America, look at another bird book that, or even go online and put those characteristics in a search engine and see what happens.
Try that, or if it's coming to a feeder fairly reliably, get a good photo of it.
Yeah.
And feel free to email me.
And we will do that. And we'll give Bill Volkert's email address here. We need to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Bill Volkert, our guest, retired wildlife educator and naturalist from the DNR. Stay with us. We'll be back after the news. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. My guest today, Bill Volkert. Bill, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, worked at Horican Marsh for 27 years, and he's been watching birds for well over 40. And so he's here to answer your bird questions. What do you have about birds that you'd like to know? Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Bill, just as we broke for news, you were about to give our caller your email address. If she had a photo that she could send of the bird, you might be able to identify it for her.
Yeah, people can always reach me at naturalist@billvolkert.com. And that's V-O-L-K-E-R-T.
naturalist@billvolkert.com. So there we go.
And also thinking about her description, she had mentioned a complete collar of red. So I was trying to imagine that as a complete ring. So I was thinking of some of the Southeast Asia birds. But perhaps, I took that a little too literally, maybe the red is just in the breast, coming up like a large collar and all the way down the breast. And that would be more typical with the black and white in the wings of the male rose-breasted grosbeak.
Oh.
So that's possibly the bird that she was looking at. But if she can get a picture, I'd be glad to take a closer look. But maybe check the field guide under rose-breasted grosbeak. It's a relative with from the cardinal. So it's in that cardinal family.
Let's go to Marie in Evansville next. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I was wondering if you could answer a question I have about pelicans. My husband and I were driving down 14, the highway, about 15 miles south of Madison, and saw what we thought were pelicans by a pond, and I'd never seen them in Wisconsin before. I'll take your answer off the air, and thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. You know, lots of pelicans in the state now, it seems, Bill.
Yes, ever since about the mid-1990s, we've been seeing a steady increase in the pelican population in Wisconsin. Most people would associate the Gulf Coast and Florida with pelicans. We do have two species, the brown pelican is a permanent resident of the southern United States and western United States, as well as the coastal areas in the Caribbean and northern central South America. The white pelican winters in the south, in the inland waters and along the Gulf Coast, but actually nests in the Great Plains, the prairie pothole region of the Dakotas, up into central Canada, and out to Yellowstone. Wisconsin is on the far eastern edge of their actual range, but we've been seeing for the last 20 years a slow spread of that population moving into Wisconsin, and also in southern Canada, they're now much more common in Ontario. So there is this range expansion, as we refer to it. Essentially, the population is spreading more to the east. And here's another very large bird that doesn't nest until they're about 5 years old. And so we do have nesting colonies in a number of places around Wisconsin, but we also have these big flocks of these non-breeders that are moving around. For a few years now, there have been some large flocks at Sheboygan on the north side of town. They've been hanging around the breakwaters there. The Winnebago chain, there is nesting going on at Lake Butamore and also just on little islands south of Oshkosh, but large numbers of birds moving there. The Mississippi River has some nesting populations on a few islands, but again, some large staging of the non-breeders as they move around or spend the summer and hang out. And some of our bigger marshes around Wisconsin are hosting populations. The first nesting was in the Green Bay and then Horicon Marsh. And they've been establishing in other places around the state. So, yes, it is a more common sight these days.
Yeah, always fun to see, too.
And a huge bird with a 10-foot wingspread.
Yeah, amazing birds. Lou Ray in Rosendale, it's your turn. Hi, Lou Ray.
Hi, Bill. This is Lou Ray, and I've been a permitted wildlife rehabilitator for many years, and I want to make a plea to the public and asking them, please do not pick up fledgling birds that are on the ground. The people see them and think they're baby birds in trouble, and they actually are just doing the normal thing. Baby fledgling birds are supposed to be on the ground for about a week after they fledge so that their parents can teach them how to find food and how to get along out of the nest. It's a major problem for we rehabilitators because we get hundreds and hundreds of baby songbirds brought in that really should not have been messed with at all.
No.
And the same plea for fawns. Many people bring in baby fawns that they found laying alone somewhere, and that also is part of their normal life. The mothers always leave them hidden somewhere just in the grass or in the woods. And the mothers move away so that they don't attract predators or people to the baby fawn.
So yeah.
Do not pick up baby fawns. They are not abandoned. If you do find a nest on the ground with the baby bird, near the baby bird, then it is in trouble, maybe.
Maybe.
But otherwise, just let nature do its thing. It's perfectly normal.
All right.
That's a great reminder, and I know... When I was at DNR, we put that out as an annual reminder of people because it is an issue that comes up time and again. And to reemphasize what you said, I know people are very concerned and they're well-meaning, but if they see a bird by itself, they assume it's been abandoned. But no, the parents are usually just off to the side, not far away. And, of course, they see you as danger, so they'll just slip off a little bit, leave it alone. As he said, if it's on the ground, put it up on a branch so it isn't vulnerable to predators and leave it there. The parents will most often come and start feeding it very quickly. Yeah, leave it out there where it belongs. Wildlife belongs in the wild, definitely.
Thanks again, Lou Ray. Let's go to Jeff in Fox Lake next. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. I was waiting for a long time to catch your program with Bill. My question concerns tree swallows. I have a farm with... a lot of grassland that gets grazed, but in a way, I usually have, I would say up to 20 to 30 birds around, and I have zero tree swallows here, whereas the barn swallows are in normal numbers. They've returned to the barn like they always did. So I'm wondering, what point in time did they not make it here?
Well, tree swallow is another one that is a very early migrant, and it always astounds me. They seem to come what I think is almost too early. They must know something that I don't. But most of our swallows don't arrive until we get well into late April. Usually barn swallows, the first ones show up about the second, certainly the third week of April. But tree swallows are peculiar. They come quite early. Sometimes the first sightings are in the last week of March, and certainly as we get into early April. That is another bird that came here before the April storm hits. So we had a very large population or at least a large percentage of them, that had already arrived early, and then that April storm hit, and it just knocked out the insects. And I know people were reporting their bluebird boxes where they found both bluebirds that had huddled in there trying to stay warm and get through the storm, as well as tree swallows, and they eventually perished. So I'm afraid to say, I think that some of yours probably arrived a little sooner than they should have with this very unusual weather. And, yeah, there was a pretty severe mortality. I guess the thing to really watch, since you've been so successful with your tree swallows over the years, is give it a chance for next year. See if, again, some of those that were successful this year in rearing young, those young come back next year, are spreading out looking for new nesting opportunities. They'll find your place again and start to rebuild that population. But, yeah, it was quite devastating for a number of birds that tend to come relatively early in the spring migration.
Oh, thanks, Jeff.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, sorry to hear that, Jeff. Thank you for calling. Rich in La Crescent, your turn. Hi, Rich.
Yes, I've had bluebirds in a nest. They had four babies in the nest there, and they all died. Can they die from heat exhaustion? Because this nest was out in full sun, a wooden box. Could they die from heat exhaustion? Should I provide shade the next time I put that nest out?
It's usually not a problem for them because bluebird nest boxes are out in full sun. They are in the open. Wood is essential because it tends to take a long time to warm up. And so usually that's not a problem for them. Blowflies, it can be a problem. These are parasites that will live down in the lower part of the nesting material and come up at night and suck the blood from them. That can lead to some real problems of high blood loss. So that could be a problem there. You know, this has always been a bit of a problem, is to really say for sure why a bird has actually died. And with DNR, we always had some suspected reasons for, you know, assuming a bird deaths, whether it was waterfowl or songbirds or something else. But it wasn't until we got them to the Wildlife Health Lab and they could actually do a laboratory analysis, could we even be conclusive. So I would be guessing exactly why, but starvation or, excuse me, heat exhaustion usually is not a problem. Yeah, we had a couple of warm spells. There could be stresses, but it would be pretty exceptional. They usually get by with that.
Rich, thank you for calling. There are some birds that are actually starting to migrate, aren't there?
Yes, where most birds are just at the height of the rearing of their young and will take some time before they even think about migrating. The first of the sandpipers are already coming back from the Arctic. And when we've talked about fall migration already starting in early mid-July, maybe it's not a good term for it, but sandpipers are a little unusual where the males will arrive in the Arctic as soon as spring starts to arrive there with them, and then they will mate, and the failed breeders and oftentimes successful breeding males, once the females are incubating and raising young, they pick up and leave. And some of the reasons are perhaps to take some of the pressure off of the feeding grounds and leave the food for them, or maybe they're moving just because they can. It's hard to say, but we are starting to see it. There have been a couple reports here in just the last few days on some of the mudflats and wetlands of the first sandpipers starting to arrive in central and southern Wisconsin. Yeah. So it is just beginning. Really, we'll start to see the peak of the sandpipers in August and then in early to mid-September. And, of course, summer is pretty short up in the Arctic, so the young are going to mature quickly, and they'll be coming down here within another month to month and a half or so.
And Dave Potratz has got a sandpiper for us here to listen to. He was. Oh, yeah. The sandpiper. What about plovers, too, right?
Yeah. We refer to them generically as shorebirds. And these are birds of the shallow water areas. So what we think of as sheet water, just, anything from barely saturated soil to just a few inches, this is their preferred feeding habitat. Plovers, the most common one that people would know is the killdeer. And we've got a few other species in Wisconsin, the endangered piping plover that nests along Lake Superior, and now we've got a nest or two along Lake Michigan shore. And then our others are Arctic breeders. But plovers and sandpipers make up one very large family of birds, and generically refer to them, lump them together as the shorebirds.
And there's a piping plover right there.
Yeah. It is still on the endangered species list for Wisconsin. The population along the Atlantic and throughout the eastern Great Lakes is doing better. And those populations are listed as threatened species. They're quite a specialist along the lake shores. And one of the problems is that their need for isolation and nesting happens to coincide with summer recreation. And so, especially on the East Coast, where we have a large human population and the beach is very attractive in summer, they've had to cordon off large areas and keep people at bay so that we provide part of the beach for the birds, let them give a chance to raise their families, and give the rest of it for people in their summer recreation and try to reduce the conflicts between the two.
Let's go to Pam in Wauwatosa next. Pam, thanks for waiting.
Hi.
What's on your mind? Yeah.
I've got a question on our neighborhood birds. This year we have very few neighborhood birds. We live in a very wooded part of Wauwatosa, and usually you go through bags of seed like crazy, and we have nothing at the feeders, no woodpeckers, no sparrows. Cardinals I saw earlier, but I don't see them now, and they don't eat the suet, they don't eat anything. There's nothing there. And we do find a couple of neighbors have reported they find birds on the ground, you know, dead.
Hmm.
Well, if they're finding birds on the ground dead, two possible causes. Usually in July, August, we start seeing especially crows that are very susceptible to West Nile virus. So that is still out there, and some birds are vulnerable to that. So diseases are a possibility. And for summer, this is not a good time to attract birds to your feeders just because there is so much natural food. They're not compelled to really come into your feeder. Now, I'm not saying not to offer food because it is oftentimes interesting to see if a cardinal or some other birds are coming with their young to the feeders. I've got rose-breasted grosbeaks that are coming right now, and they'll be bringing their young to the seed feeder here shortly. So it's nice to be able to see it, but they don't come in big numbers like they do in winter when food is much more in short supply. So just because they're not coming to your feeder does not mean that the birds are not out there. But I will caution people that summertime with the high temperatures and humidity, the spoilage of seed and other food is much more likely. So offer a little bit less, and sanitation is important because botulism and salmonella are diseases that are fairly common among different bird populations in summertime with the heat. So we do sometimes see from salmonella outbreaks around bird feeders. So sanitation is important. Every so often when you find your feeders empty, bring it in, use some warm water and bleach, disinfect it, rinse it again, and start over and keep things clean. That's very important.
Thanks, Pam. Appreciate it. And Doug in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Doug.
Morning. Say, I have a question about my bluebird box, but first I had a chuckle when you said how the birds might stand back and watch you observe their young if it's on the ground. I wouldn't want to try that with a red-winged blackbird. Would you agree?
Well, red-winged blackbirds, yeah, they may watch at a bit of a distance. And really what's happening is birds, because they raise a large number of young, they oftentimes are more concerned about saving themselves because there's a chance for them to re-nest. So it's not that they're heartless, but they will try to save themselves and hope that nothing happens to the young, and then when danger passes, come back again. However, there are some birds that will be very aggressive around their nests. Red-winged blackbirds are certainly known. They'll dive bomb you and try to keep you away. And I think anybody who's ever had a robin nesting right by one of their, say, the light by the front porch or something, here's a bird that sometimes may not be real welcoming of your guests when they come to the door either.
Oh.
So that'll be essentially the protection of the nest site itself. But once the young are out, they'll stand back a little bit and let the young fend for themselves and then slip in and give them food whenever possible.
Oh. Doug, did you have a question about the bluebird itself?
Right. What do I do when another bird takes the nest over? Do I let it finish its entire nesting process?
Well, I would recommend that you go to the website of the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin. They've got a lot of recommendations for successful establishment and management of bluebird trails. If it is a house sparrow, that's a serious problem, and that's a bird that you don't want in there. However, if you have tree swallows or house wrens or maybe chickadees that are using it, well, those are native birds and they need a nest site too. Then I guess the best solution is to offer an additional box or two and maybe provide an alternative site for the bluebirds. What kind of bird do you have that's occupying the bluebird box?
I think it's a wren.
Okay. Yeah, house wrens, they can get a little aggressive. They're very feisty for their little size. And they have been known at times to actually enter other nest boxes and try to kill some of the young or pip the eggs to try to reduce some competition in the neighborhood. But they like to be right near where there's shrubs and cover. So you may want to move that nest box a little more out in the open, and the bluebird is a little more attracted to that, keep it away from the trees and shrubs. The proximity to that shelter is more what the wren would prefer.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks for calling. Appreciate the call. And Dennis in St. Paul, hi.
Hi, Larry. Wonderful show. I love all your wildlife and bird stuff, especially the bird stuff. I just wanted to mention that during that April storm, I was sitting here on my houseboat on the Mississippi River in downtown St. Paul, and I was watching tree swallows in the snow feeding on aquatic insects that were hatching out of the river, and there was a loon floating by at the same time.
Uh-huh.
So, not a typical combination of birds, is it?
No.
But certainly those tree swallows were going to make it.
Yeah, they were getting a good meal there. Well, that's very cool. And Bill, we're starting to run out of time here.
Sure.
a little bit. Just for the next few weeks, what should we be watching for?
Well, first of all, as I said, if you've got a bird feeding station, watch a little bit for some of the local birds that will be bringing their young to the feeders. Watch also as birds that have been really quite secretive and quite quiet throughout the summer become a little more active as they start moving around and eventually flocking up, so they may become a little more visible. If you're going to do a little traveling around Wisconsin, you have a good chance to be able to see some of the adults with their families, so you visit marshes, you might see the coots, gallinules, geese, and ducks with their young out there. That's always enjoyable, some great photo opportunities. And also for people who are doing a little bit of bird watching, this is that transition time. The first shorebirds are starting to show up. And we may also get this, what we call a post-nesting dispersal or wandering. And so there are some birds that nest south of Wisconsin that, as they finish up a nesting season, there's quite a bit of summer left, and they start moving around. And here's a chance for, say, little blue heron, snowy egrets, the glossy or white-faced ibis, they may start wandering from those southerly nesting sites and show up in Wisconsin.
Oh, that's very cool. You know what? We're out of time, Bill.
Oh, always too sad. We never have enough, do we? But thanks so much for having me, Larry.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it very much. By the way, tomorrow at 11:45, we'll be talking to the author of a great new birding book that's designed for children. So hope you can join us. For that, always fun to talk with Bill Volkert. We'll have him back. And in the meantime, thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.